Listen to us round the clock on the net over 360. You're listening to the 365 Sports.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Blittner, and to my left, on a very historic episode, we have not one, not two, but three co-hosts here with us today, starting with our normal co-host, Daniel Green, our returning special guest co-host, Walt Bonet, and our new special guest co-host, who's recently engaged, Jared Fertig. And please, if you did not catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com. This is outside the studio, so for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports takes on this, our milestone 21st episode. That is right, our show is old enough to legally drink, and we have four amazing hosts here today to take you through the world of professional sports. And I want to get us kick-started. Guys, who here has not seen that Javi Baez shenanigans yesterday in the Cubs-Pirates game? Javi Baez should have been out. There should have been no runs scored.
Matt, you got to give them a little bit of a background. You got to get a little background.
So yeah. What happened was Javi Baez hit ground ball to left side of the infield, throw those little wide to first baseman Will Tredge, and instead of stepping on first base for the force out, Tredge decides to chase him back towards home plate because Baez wants to avoid the tag, and a run comes in around the bases to score, and I mean, it's and somehow Baez ends up on second base. And by the way, if any of you have not seen the play, you can go to Daniel Green's Twitter, which is at dbgreen3128. It is his pinned tweet on his profile. Guys, this is absolute shenanigans that don't belong in the major leagues. They don't belong in the little leagues, but somehow they most certainly do not belong in the major leagues.
Matt, you're not giving due credit to Javier Baez. The CIA or the intelligence community really needs to recruit him because he played mind games with those Pirates.
It's such a psychological barrier. He was able to get somebody who's been playing the game for over 20 years to completely forget the rules. Like, that's crazy, just by changing the way that he did things.
It's like playing in the Sandlot, you know, just some backyard shenanigans.
Jared, I think they're in a pickle. That's backyard baseball for you.
And look, I don't care the shenanigans, the mind games that he played. Look, I give him credit for, you know, thinking of running back towards home. But how, as a major league first baseman, do you allow yourself to get caught up in that to the point where not only does a run score, but the runner that you should have just stepped on first base to have out ends up at second base? It's absolutely inexcusable that this is happening, that this happened in a Major League Baseball game. I do not care what anyone else says. This is crazy is not the word for it. It really is inexcusable.
But Matt, that's what we love about baseball. Baseball is a sport where you have so many little quirks. So many different things can happen, so many different scenarios, and this is just another example of a crazy play that you would have never thought of coming to fruition, and I loved this play because of it, and I felt like we had to talk about it. It was demanded, it was so showy.
We did absolutely have to talk about it, and I'm glad that we got this off our chest. We're going to right now, we're going to move to our New York teams, who in the NBA are both in the playoffs, and guys, I can't remember the last time that was a case where both the Knicks and the Nets were in the playoffs. And I want to get started here with the Knicks. You know, Julius Randle, he just won the Most Improved Player Award. Kudos to him for that. The Knicks are tied 1-1 in their series with Atlanta. By the way, Game 3 is tonight at 7 o'clock in Atlanta. And, you know, you have to wonder which Knicks team is it that's going to show up. Is it going to be the Game 1 Knicks who lost 107-105? And who really didn't look all that good for most of the game? Or is it going to be the Game 2 Knicks who won 101-92, who made the furious comeback and had Madison Square Garden rocking circa 1994?
See, I think you're really going to see the what you saw in the second half of that Knicks game. You know, Julius Randle kind of needed that push to really get himself into the, you know, into that playoff feel. And I really think it took Derrick Rose's veteran presence that really helped Julius Randle. I feel like break through that barrier, because these are his first two playoff games. I mean, he's carried the Knicks all season. But you know what? He really, you know, like he just didn't show up those first couple games.
But again, the bigger thing about the Knicks is always going to be a question of what can they do against the Hawks? What can they do against Trae Young? Trae Young was able to score 30 in Game 2. He had the game winner in Game 1. And the Knicks don't have a presence like that. And that's what I'm concerned about with this series is you're seeing the power of having a star. And Trae Young showed up, while Julius Randle, yeah, maybe he's going to break through going forward, but it wasn't necessarily on display in the first two games.
And I hate to be that guy, but I'm going to be that guy. There's no way the Knicks can pull that off in Atlanta. They truly needed the fans this last game to win. The fans were truly the sixth man on that team who pushed Randle at the end of the game to get him to start playing better, who pushed Derrick Rose, who got into Trae Young's head. And without them in Atlanta, there's no way the Knicks can pull it off.
So hold on a second. You're saying there's no way that the four seed can pull off a split in Atlanta, where after they won three, after they won the season series, they swept the season series from the Hawks. And look, I know regular season is different than the postseason. It's the old adage, obviously. Games are different. Things are a lot different. You mean to tell me they can't win one game in Atlanta? I highly, highly disagree with you on that.
I don't question the grit. I don't question the intensity, but I question the talent. It's not there.
Well, that's where Tom Thibodeau comes in. And I mean, if the man really is a coach of the year, he's going to have them up. And look, I do not think they're going to win both games in Atlanta. I know that that's not going to happen. But they can certainly get at least one game there and force this back to the Garden.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think. I think you saw the adjustments. I mean, you know, series is fluid. Like, you know, you move through the games, you move through the halves, and you make adjustments. And I really feel like the Knicks made those adjustments. I mean, the Hawks don't just magically shoot 28% in the second half from the field. You know, that's The Knicks have always relied on their defense. They've had the best defense all year, and I really feel like it came alive in that second half. And don't get me wrong, like the Garden was absolutely rocking to get that vibe from the fans. Like, you know, there's just nothing like it.
And that's going to be the key. That's been the key to the Knicks' success all year. That's what Thibodeau brought to this team, was that defensive intensity. And you saw it on display. You saw it holding them to only 92 points. That's unbelievable in today's NBA, especially with a team that can score in that many different ways like Atlanta. The question is, does the losing the home field lose that? Is the defense correlated with the home field?
In order for the Knicks to win a game in Atlanta, everything needs to go right. There needs to be perfect and total cohesion.
But that's been all season and things have gone right.
They need three games of that.
Well, we'll see what's going to happen. I am choosing to believe in our Knickerbockers that they can pull off at least a game in Atlanta and make this a prolonged series. And look, I'm not saying the Knicks are going to win this series. I don't think any of the four of us are saying that it's a slam dunk that they're going to win or even lose a series. But the experience that they're going to gain from potentially a 6 or 7 game series is going to be very important for this young team, especially heading into next year. And that's what this has to be about. If they win this series, great. If they win this series, we'll all be on board for a round two. But the experience is almost more important at this point. And I have to think that that is going to supersede the feelings of, well, they lost in six and, you know, the disappointment that will follow. Because they weren't supposed to make it this far anyway this year. So, you know, you have to view this through a glass half full prism. Am I right?
No, see, I disagree. I don't think you look back at day one and you say, well, you know what, we made the playoffs. Day one expectations were, you know, what, 10 maybe? The 10 seed, you know, you're kind of playing for? But I think you have to reevaluate, you know, later in the season and at the end. You know, if the Knicks go out in 6 games, I think that would be a massive disappointment. I don't care where you started day one. It would be a massive disappointment if the Knicks lose this series.
Well, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see again, everyone. That is Game 3 starting tonight at 7 o'clock in Atlanta. So I highly suggest you tune in and listen to that. And, I mean, not to tell you who you should listen to on the broadcast, but Mike Breen has been killing it on the air, just like he has been for so long. You know, let's hope that Breen can have a couple of signature or moments here tonight to really help make this a memorable game. Going to the Knicks, crosstown rivals, though, the Nets. This is a series that really isn't in doubt. They're up 2-0 on the Celtics. Game 3 is also tonight. That's at 8:30 in Boston. And, I mean, guys, I think the only question is whether Boston's going to avoid a sweep or if they're, you know, can they avoid the sweep and win a game? Or is this going to be just, you know, breaking out the brooms for the Nets? Because this is really an anticlimactic series.
It was never expected to be a good series, but it's been even worse than expected. What I see with this Nets team is a team that obviously has the most talent of any team in the league, and they're hitting their stride. Does Boston steal a game? I would say they'd get one game. I would say Tatum, I would say they have enough talent, and they have enough fight to make one game. But I think ultimately, whether it's losing in four, losing in five, the Nets have this in the bag and need to move on to Milwaukee.
All right. First off, I just consider this a regular season game. This is barely the playoffs. The Celtics do not look good at all for the Nets. I'm already looking at the Bucks. I'm already a little concerned about the Bucks. I think the Nets, with their lack of defense, Giannis is going to back them out of the paint. But yeah, I'm not even thinking about this series.
And look, as long as the Nets have that big three going, it's going to be difficult for any team, even the Bucks, to, you know, have an advantage over them. But I question whether the big three is going to be able to carry them all the way to finish the job. I know that they have looked good so far in the playoffs outside of the first, you know, quarter or so of game one. I don't know, and people in Brooklyn and across New York City can vilify me all they want for this. I don't know that this big three has what it's going to take to get the Nets all the way this year. And, I mean, guys, am I loony on this, or is there something to this?
I think you're loony. I mean, I'm a diehard Knicks fan. I'm not really rooting for the Nets, but there's just too much talent there. And it's not even just the big three. I mean, you know, Joe Harris can't seem to miss from behind the arc, you know? It's just That team is an absolute locomotive right now. I think they're, you know, wheels are greased and they're moving forward.
Let's not forget that Blake Griffin has turned this team into Lob Borough TM, not Lob City.
But and look, I famously on this show, once the James Harden trade happened, I picked them to win the finals. So I have to stand by that. But there are a couple of concerning things. Giannis will be a concern. The Sixers will be a concern. But ultimately, you can't stop them. And all you have to do in basketball, as is obviously stated, is score more points than the other team. How could any team outscore this big three?
And what I think is interesting is that the way the Nets won their two games. Because the first game was really, it was defense. It was very defense heavy. They played very good defense. And then it was the second game where basically their offense took over. With those, you know, it's not like it's one or the other. They have both things going for them. And if they put them both together in a single game, you know, like I'd be very hard pressed to say that there's any team that can just, you know, take them in a 7-game series.
Well, I don't know that they're going to get to a 7-game series at this point. Just I don't see, even against a team like Philadelphia or against Milwaukee, I don't see them having a 7-game series because the offense is either going to be blistering hot, where they're going to run through everyone in a short series, or their defense is going to collapse to the point where they're going to get taken advantage of. So I don't know that they even have a 7-game series in them. And I mean, I know that, you know, picking very small things to pick at here, but I just don't see that happening in here. However, one team that most certainly is not doing anything with offense and yet is winning games is the New York Islanders of the National Hockey League, who Wednesday night, for the first time since we were born, essentially, won and closed out a playoff series at Nassau Coliseum, and they did it in style against Sidney Crosby and the Penguins as they won Game 6, 5-3, just like they did 5-3 against the Capitals in April of 1993. The Islanders had an opportunistic offense at best, a non-existent offense at worst, but the defense and the goaltending especially stole that series for them, and they're looking to do that again against the Bruins starting tomorrow night. Guys, this could be one of those situations where goalie could run away with the Conn Smythe voting real quick if they get far.
And again, with hockey, as we always say, what wins series? Hot goaltending. That's such a key. I can think of so many series, the Rangers when they had Lundqvist, the Kings when they had Quick. You can just rattle off so many series where the team didn't necessarily have the most talent, but the goaltending kept them intact, and the goaltending pushed them forward. Now, famously, I'm going to make it famously, last week on the show, we discussed the fact that it was time to make a change, and that it was time to switch out Varlamov and time to put in Sorokin. And doing that seems to have been what broke the difference. They've won three in a row with him in, behind net, and
He stole a couple of those games. He made 50 saves.
50 saves out of 52 is an unbelievable percentage. We can't overstate that enough. And the fact that he was able to do that, wow.
So basically you're saying that you've taken Walt's title of Nostradamus, the predictor, away from him because you said that on the show that they should make the switch.
All of Daniel's commentary is just trying to prove his Jekyll and Hyde theory about the Islanders.
Elaborate here, one of you, because I wasn't aware that we had Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in attendance today.
Well, I think there is truth to that with the Islanders, and you saw it with the offense, you saw it with Palmieri, you saw it with that team after the trade deadline all of a sudden getting cold, and we discussed who's going to show up. Is it going to be the team that's streaky in the losing category, who isn't cohesive, who doesn't seem to have enough goals, or is it going to be the team where Palmieri scores three goals in the playoffs, the whole team becomes more of an X factor? And that's the good question. Like, is it Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde against this Bruins team that is tough? That is tough, that is gritty, that is experienced. I am so ecstatic for this series.
I mean, look, if the Islanders can continue to get contributions, especially from the Anthony Beauvillier, Brock Nelson, Josh Bailey line, I mean, that trio had 8 points in game six. If they can continue to be the weapon that they've been in the playoffs, it's going to be very, very interesting what's going to happen. And look, we can talk all you want about how the Islanders are the fourth seed, so they're going to get games 3 and 4 at home. The Islanders faithful that packed out Nassau Coliseum, first at 6,800 for game 3, and game 4, and then 9,000 for game 6. I mean, they talked about the fans taking over the game and being the seventh man out there. That was insanity. I've never seen, and I've seen plenty of different arenas. I've experienced the Nashville Predators fans. I've experienced the Rangers fans at the Garden. You name it, I've seen it around the league. I have never seen a fan base in reduced numbers, which obviously is not within their control due to this world situation of the pandemic, take over a game in a series the way the Islanders fans just did.
Yeah, am I crazy for getting nostalgic about Nassau Coliseum? I understand from an amenity perspective, it's not a hockey arena. It's not an acceptable arena. But I just think you lose something when you lose that fan base and the way that that arena is. It was where my first hockey game was. It was where my second hockey game was. I have a lot of good memories from that. And when that Islanders crowd gets into a game, we saw it. We saw the way that they were cheering on Barzal. We saw it throughout the series of...
Cheering on Barzal. They were singing happy birthday to him while he went on a breakaway, essentially.
And that's the point, is you're going to lose that with Belmont. But look, we don't need to talk about next year. For now, this stadium is absolutely going to be a factor.
For sure. It's the Nassau Coliseum reminds me of the old Chase Stadium or the Rogers Center in Toronto. It's a concrete jungle. And when you're not sitting in a nice place, it just makes you want to be rowdier and get louder and support your team.
I mean, look, they were out there. definitely supporting the team. They were tailgating at 1 o'clock for a 6:30 game. I wasn't aware that in the National Coliseum parking lot, which, by the way, was not open at 1 o'clock, they were having lounge chairs outside the parking lot doing that at the time. And that's what's great about the Islanders. And, you know, they're going to play the Bruins right now, starting tomorrow night. And I want to run through where they match up offense, defense, goaltending with the Bruins, because this is going to be interesting. Offensively, we know the Bruins have the perfection line of Bergeron, Marchand, and everyone. It's not going to be pretty trying to stop that line. It's not going to be pretty trying to stop the second line with Taylor Hall. But after that, the Bruins' bottom six does not really have much. The Islanders, though, while they can't match up with the first line, they get those contributions 1 through 12, and that could very much be a difference maker when it comes to offense. And I'm curious to see what you guys think in terms of how whether star scoring or depth scoring is going to be the key to this.
Ultimately, it's offensively, you can't match up with that first line. It's going to be too much for the Islanders. But I think the real key to this series is going to be this goaltending battle. And what is the hot hand versus the old school veteran? They're not going to get.
I mean, we don't even know if Sorokin is technically getting the start in game one. You would think he would, but Barry Trotz being who he is and how he doesn't like to name goalies, there's a chance he does go back to Varlamov, and I don't know that that would be the right move. In fact, I don't think that that would be the right move, but it would be interesting if he does choose to make the goalie switch for the new series.
Yeah, I feel like you have to ride the hot hand. You know, you get a goalie who's playing out of his mind. But you know, I guess speaking of goaltenders, you know, you're not going to have Tristan Jarry in the net. You know, you're not going to have a Swiss cheese goalie who can't seem to stop anything. You're going to have a veteran who's been to so many different playoff series in Tuukka Rask. He's used to the limelight. He's used to these big games. Like, it's really hard to knock experience, you know, when it comes to the playoffs. And however hot, you know, one is, I always think that the veteran presence seems to kind of overwhelm it. I don't know.
I mean, the Bruins don't have that veteran presence on the blue line anymore after Chara left, and they just knocked out their old buddy Chara, who's with the Capitals now. So they have a dynamic blue line, more so than the Islanders, but again, it's depth for the Islanders. 1 through 6 on defense. And I know the second pair of Mayfield and Leddy has had its issues, but is this going to be a case again where depth is going to override the star power of Charlie McAvoy and company?
And this also comes to another question. When we talked about the Penguins, this was sort of a similar debate, right? Because the Penguins are star-studded, and we sort of had this similar discussion. But again, the one difference was the goaltending. Because yes, Boston is star-studded, but with the Penguins, you just had such a lapse there that it didn't matter. You can't win games if you're giving up 3 goals within 3 minutes.
No, you can't. And boy, was that an exciting in 2 minutes and 59 seconds to see 3 goals scored, game tire, go ahead, and then the insurance policy. That was, if you want to talk about getting the fans rotting, that was it. In terms of getting people rotting, though, you should all want to go out and use the new rocking pool equipment bites that our sponsor provides. And Dan, you're our sponsor, guys. So why don't you tell our fans a little bit about our number one company that we like to root for?
Joco has had another successful week in New York. They actually had their month-iversary yesterday, the one-month anniversary of Joco launching. They are the most sustainable and enjoyable way to commute around New York City. It's an electric assist bike share program with 100 private locations across Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. Micromobility has grown significantly over the last 15 months, and it's easy to see why. Most trips in New York are faster and more convenient on a bike than on the subway. And these bikes, they're electrically assisted. They go fast. They're sleek. They take a lot less effort. They're far easier on hills. And look, our co-host Walt Bonet and yours truly had a ride on the bike last weekend. And what I can say about it was a smooth ride. It was enjoyable. We went up the west side, got to look at Little Island a little bit, and had a really great day that we both enjoyed.
It was an incredible ride. Me and Daniel had a nice romantic ride where we watched the sunset. And the first thing
did your fiance know about that?
she wants to ride Joko too. It was really the smoothest ride ever, and I'm looking forward to the next time.
And for a limited time only, we're giving out a promo code. So it is OTS15 for a 15-minute ride. And it is OTSMEM for a membership. Memberships allow you to have 45-minute rides completely free. And they are $53 per month. It's much cheaper than the alternatives out there. And it's a much better deal. So once again, the promo code is OTS15 for a free 15-minute ride, and OTSMEM for a discount from a membership. Helps out the show, helps out our sponsor. So check out the website at RideJoko.com. That is RideJoko.com, and the Instagram account at RideJoko for updates.
Now, I'm a little curious, and Jared, I wonder if you feel the same way here. If two of our four hosts here had this nice little, quote-unquote, romantic bike ride using the Johto bikes, where was our invite?
Next time, Matt.
I think that was addressing Jared.
Next time, Matt.
I didn't get the invite. Don't know why.
Wow, guys. I thought we were a tight-knit show here.
We had a very nice time.
Oh, I'm sure you had a nice time, Walt. I'm sure you had a very nice time, considering that you chose to use the word romantic for the two of you going out and riding your bikes.
It was a great time, and it was a great way to spend a Sunday. And Matt, you and I will have our own bromantic ride one of these days.
I mean, I feel like Jared should be included in this too. I feel like you're intentionally trying to exclude him, and that's not cool.
No, we'll definitely get Jared too. Everybody who wants to come on will come on.
All right. Well, now that we're done busting each other's chops with that, let's get to the teams that split the four of us right down the middle, and that are the Yankees and Mets. Guys, I'll say this about our hometown baseball teams. They're dealing with a lot of injuries. Not a few injuries. They're dealing with a lot of injuries. The Yankees are stuck in third place right now, even though they've been hot. And the Mets are in first place in the NL East, but for how much longer, I don't know, considering they seem to be dropping like flies every day. So, I want to run down a brief list for a minute of the injuries facing these teams. For the Mets, you have Jeff McNeil out, Brandon Nimmo, Tarjan Walker, Michael Conforto, Noah Syndergaard, who just was shut down again in his rehab from Tommy John surgery, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. Dellin Betances, Kevin Pillar, who was hit in the face by a gruesome fastball. By the way, whoever writes our notes clearly doesn't know how to write the word fastball, but that's a different story. Albert Almora, Luis Guillermo, and Vargas, who collided with the wall in center field. Guys, that's the Mets injuries. The Yanks right now, Torey Kluber's been shut down 8 weeks. Luke Voit just had a tricky oblique that put him on the IL, so that's definitely an issue. Giancarlo Stantonacci was just activated. Aaron Hicks is out for the rest of the season with wrist surgery. That's been an abomination of a contract, which again we'll get into in a few minutes. And Zach Britton is still working his way back. Guys, you could fill out an entire roster for a team with those guys who are all injured right now. How are the two New York teams staying afloat?
No, the Mets legit have a 9-team IL list starting roster. It's really an unprecedented amount of injuries. It's concerning, and they're in first place in the NL East, so they really need some help. They're going to have to hit the trade market soon. I'm hoping they trade for Frazier, but they really need something if they're going to stay top of this NL East.
Which Frazier would that be, Walt?
Todd.
Oh, okay, I was about to say, Yanks aren't trading Clint Frazier to the Mets.
You're not taking Clint from us.
No, but ultimately that's what is going to be interesting to see with the Mets going forward. That Syndergaard setback, when I saw the news, I was pretty depressed. I'm not going to lie about it, because that was going to be that push, that extra ace that the team needed to push forward. And now he's not going to be out. He's going to be out for the year. I mean, they're not saying it yet, but he's done for the year.
Yeah, but imagine a playoffs where Syndergaard makes his debut on game one of the playoffs.
I mean, I don't see that being the case, because, first of all, game one, that's Jacob DeGrom's spot. Are you really trying to disrespect your own ace pitcher right there?
True. I need to apologize to the baseball gods.
He does, but even Syndergaard in game two, having that 1-2, having Carrasco back, having that kind of rotation is terrifying. And, you know, Carrasco's still hurt. Syndergaard just had another setback. It's still a deep rotation, so the Mets still have a chance to be really strong, but that was a big one. That really hurt me in the guts.
I think that's baseball now. I think the pitchers seem to be, you know, getting injured at almost an alarming rate, but I think baseball now, and I think teams are really starting to understand that you don't go out and have five pitchers. You should plan for a 7 and 8 man. You know, like, because you are bound to have guys go down. You know, you really need to plan for 7 or 8 guys, and I think the Yankees are more or less doing that. I mean, you have a few guys who are, you know, a couple months away. You know, Severino is probably coming back, what, July, something like that?
Assuming he has no
assuming he has no setbacks. But, you know, Yankees go out and get Kluber and Tyone, and, you know, you don't actually know if these guys are, you know, going to perform, and obviously Kluber threw a no-hitter, and he performed, but, you know, obviously now we can get into it in a second, but he's hurt.
And look, that's you have to feel awful for Kluber. After what he's gone through the last 2 years with injuries, to come back, he throws the no-hitter, looks unbelievable. That slider was moving feet. It really was. And then for him to come up and have his shoulder hurt again, and to the point where he's going to be shut down 8 weeks, 4 no throwing, and then 4 to build back up. Guys, I don't know that Kluber is going to... you have to wonder when might be curtains permanently for him. Because the shoulder, the more you injure it in baseball, that's the one thing that they haven't figured out yet. They can fix your elbow with Tommy John surgery. You can come back throwing harder. You can have a whole new career. The shoulder, every time it gets hurt, it's less and less, and you have to wonder what's going to be left for him.
So, Matt, I hate to bring this up, because I only love talking about the positive news of our show, but we jinxed Kluber.
No,
that's what happened.
You jinxed Kluber. Yeah. You're the jinx.
Okay, this is the thing. This is a guy who didn't throw a pitch in 2020. This is a guy who was severely limited in 2019. It's an injury-prone person who... he started to turn that corner. You saw the light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm not going to say name names.
We didn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. We were out of the tunnel. He threw a no-hitter. We were out of the tunnel.
And I'm not going to name names, but some people who may be on the show got a little bit excited for him and thought that he had finally turned that corner. But again, with the Yankees, what you've always worried about throughout this season is it's a deep rotation if the guys were healthy. But with these injuries, they're really not. They're really a problematic rotation and really don't have what it takes to be my World Series pick, which they still have to remain.
I will say what's concerning is that with these injuries, Aaron Judge is going to have to play more games, and we all know that he will not sustain himself playing 100% of the workload.
Before we get to Aaron Judge, because that's an interesting point, Walt, I'd like to bring up something that, just because I feel I'm taking a dig at the two Mets fans here on our show, I think Corey Kluber might evoke memories of a certain former Mets pitcher who threw a somewhat questionable no-hitter by the name of Johan Santana.
It was not questionable. It was really not a no-hitter. That's what it was.
As long as you admit it.
Matt, I heard you when talking about the Knicks earlier say you gotta believe, and that's a Mets term, so I think we've imputed that on you.
I mean, you gotta believe is a lot of different teams use that. The Mets use it, the Rangers use it, the Islanders use it, the Yankees use it, the Knicks use it, the Nets use it, the Jets use it, the Giants use it. I can keep going, so what's your point here?
I'm pretty sure it solely belongs to the Mets, and you are now a Mets fan.
Really? I know you're about to become a full-time lawyer, but I don't believe the Mets have the trademark on that, so I'd go back and check that degree of yours.
But regardless, as a Mets fan, I hate to give you this, but I think Corey Kluber's no-hitter is much more apparent than Santana's.
Well, of course, there was no controversy. He almost threw a perfect game.
He did, and that 3-0 pitch that Kluber threw that they called ball four, I thought was a little borderline in my opinion. But, you know, obviously hindsight's 20/20 through the no-hitter. But and I'm sad to see Kluber because Kluber go down with this injury because I really did, I was on board. I was like, wow, you know what? He was working up to it. He looked better in his last couple starts. And you know, some people might be saying, well, maybe he threw too many pitches, but he really only threw like just over, I think, 101 is no hitter.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of this controversy about, well, you guys know he has an injury history. Why did you let him throw? But he didn't throw that many pitches. That's the thing. And really, for people saying that, it's not, you can't predict these kind of things with injuries. It's just part of the game. And you can't just caution your whole life about that.
Speaking of the you can't predict, how do you think the Yankees feel right now with Aaron Hicks? They signed him coming off a pretty good year a few years ago to a 7-year, $70 million deal, $10 million a year, obviously. And it's been nothing but one injury after another with him since then. Guys, I hate to throw around the term worst, but this might very well be the worst contract ever handed out by the Yankees. How many games is he going to end up playing? It's nothing.
Totally disagree. Well, I mean, I agree that Aaron Hicks' contract was a terrible contract, but that contract isn't even the worst contract given to a Yankees outfielder in the last decade, okay? Jacoby Ellsbury is the single worst contract.
At least Jacoby Ellsbury performed when he was out there, though.
No. Okay, Aaron.
Look, Ellsbury, I'll give you, was horrible.
And Ellsbury was also later in his career. Aaron Hicks was arguably moving into his prime. He's a switch hitter. He's fast. He's a fantastic glove. He's an amazing arm. He had all the tools. You know, everything looked promising for him. I stand by the Yankees' decision to offer him that contract. When he has been healthy, he has delivered, in my opinion. But no, I also will go back to my original point and say Jacoby Ellsbury is the single worst contract.
Wait. The Yankees have had a lot of bad contracts. And by the way, as have the Mets. We can all talk about Mo Vaughn all day long. We can talk about a lot of guys. I think the
Bobby
worst...
Bonilla?
Bobby Bonilla is the best contract in Mets history.
They're still paying that one.
But, by the way, Carl Pavano has to be the worst contract in Yankees history, right? I mean, there's been a lot of bad ones, but the thing with this is this too late? Is it too late to turn it around? I mean, the guy's still... He's not that old. It's not over for him. Now, this season, he's going to be shut down, but is it over? Is it already decided as the worst contract? There's no coming back from it?
I mean, we're in, what, year two of this contract? I have to think that if this continues, it's going to be right up there with that. Look, I know there's been a lot of bad contracts, and of course, you know, you bring up the Ellsbury, you bring out the Pavano. This is one of those things where you hate to see a young player especially, get struck down by the injury bug. And it's not even the same injury each time, it's a different injury each time. It's something that you really just, you have to stop and question, why is this happening to him? And until you can find an answer, there's no way to fix this.
But this is the question, and really the whole thing about what we're talking about. Is this a COVID thing? Are these massive buildup of injuries related to the craziness that's happened in the last 2 years?
I see you've been reading The Athletic, but...
Also logic and common sense, but yeah.
Where they were talking about that, but that would deal more for the pitchers than that would for the hitters.
Well, I partially agree with you, Daniel, because these players who are getting injured more are also playing less. Pitchers are getting pulled out earlier than they've ever played before. Hitters like Aaron Judge are hitting less than they've ever played before, and they're still getting injured more, so it has to be this new environment.
Look, we can keep talking about the injuries, but there's something that we do need to get to before we move to our next segment, and that's the fact that the Mets swept their doubleheader yesterday, so kudos to you guys, and the Yankees split their doubleheader. Guys, it's the 7-inning doubleheaders seem, in my opinion, and you can call me a traditionalist, a purist, you can call me whatever you want on it, get the... You gotta get rid of those seven-inning doubleheaders. And for those of you who wondered why I took the pause, you know what I was about to say.
Yeah, Matt, I totally agree with you. I'm surprised. I'm not a traditionalist. I like the evolution of baseball. I like the way certain things are going, but I hate the seven-inning doubleheader. I hate the seven-inning doubleheaders. I hate the runner on second in the 10th inning.
Don't even get me started on that.
I think
one.
You should wait till like the 11th inning, I think.
No, you shouldn't have that period.
But I mean, yes, I totally agree. I hate the 7-inning doubleheaders because it's just there's so much that happens, obviously, you know, in the latter third of the game. You know, you get into the belly of the bullpens, you know. You have to make someone go out there and get those last six outs, and those a lot of times are the hardest six outs to get.
Because it's who can get the big out in the big situation. And if you look at those games yesterday, I actually think it provides the Mets with an advantage to have those seven innings. Because all of a sudden you've got Stroman, you've got guys who can really push themselves, and the pitching yesterday was immaculate. They won 1-0, and they only gave up 2 runs in the second game. If you're going to pitch like that, you're going to win games, and if you're going to have less innings, you're going to have more of an ability to pitch like that, and it's going to really play into the Mets' hands, I think.
All right, guys, speaking of the big moments, we're going to dust off something we haven't done for a while, and that's a top five list. Inspired, yes, by Don LaGreca's Daily Don with the Michael Kay Show. We're going to do a top five of the greatest sports playoff moments, individual or singular, whatever word you want, playoff moments in the NBA, MLB, NFL, NHL since 2011, so the last decade. The way we broke it down, folks, there is one baseball moment, one football moment, one hockey moment, and two basketball moments. Guys, let's have at it and see if you can guess what five are on this list. Dan, why don't you get us started?
Okay. I want to talk about a moment that is very dear to my heart because I was watching this moment in Italy in 2013 at 4 o'clock in the morning. I stayed up for it, and that is Game 6, Miami Heat, San Antonio Spurs, Ray Allen's shot, the one from three, the one that iced that Game 6, and then the Heat went on to win Game 7, winning that series against the Spurs. That has to be on the list.
You know, I thought about it.
You're crazy. I don't even want to hear the next part of this sentence. You're crazy.
It just missed the cut. I thought about it, and it just missed.
All right. My guess is which yielded the greatest meme of all time, and this is the greatest meme in the pre-TikTok era, but the Warriors blowing a 3-1 lead.
That's not a moment, Walt.
But piggybacking off of
so
that.
So the block?
Yeah.
No, that also did not make the list.
Okay, then I change mine to Kyrie's step back three-pointer to... What?
First of all, I'm already doubting the validity of this list. I actually loved the Kyrie step back, but nothing's going to beat the block. Nothing on this list could possibly beat the block. Of LeBron going back to Cleveland, winning a title after being down 3-1, that block changed the whole game. Matt, this list is ludicrous, but we will push on.
No. Okay, first of all, one of these, since you guys seem to be trying to go for one of the two basketball first, one of these should be clearly obvious for what it should be, considering it only happened a couple years ago, okay? It's a major, major moment.
Okay, so this is what I'm thinking that it is. So you're somebody who likes to be a little bit controversial. You wanted to not pick the big moments, but you do like the iconic, you do like the suspense, you do like the mystery. I have to think it's Kawhi's shot. It's Kawhi's shot, the double rim bounce.
Kawhi Leonard for the Raptors, Game 7, 2019 Eastern Semis, buzzer beater versus the 76ers in Toronto. That makes number 3 on the list. Toronto had won multiple playoff series in years leading up to the moment. Toronto, even though they were favored, it was very much in doubt that game. And that Kawhi Leonard shot will live on forever. That is number 3.
I mean, it's not crazy. I mean, that really carried them to win the finals, which was such an unbelievable thing. So I do think that does belong on the list.
But behind the block, of course.
Of course, behind the block. Of course, behind the block.
I'll take a stab at one of the other ones. So for football, I'm gonna guess the football one. I will say, arguably one of the best moments in Super Bowl history. I'm gonna have to say, not handing the ball to Marshawn Lynch and throwing the interception at the 1 yard line to Malcolm Butler.
I thought about it. That did not make the list.
Okay, wait. That is because of a thing, actually, Jared, that Matt, a cognitive bias that Matt has, which is he doesn't like putting failures on this list. That's probably the reason that you left it off, right?
That is a very good point there.
That's reasonable, yeah.
That goes on Matt's not top five.
Okay, I'm going to go with...
Hey, Dan, why don't you let Walt have a guess here?
Yeah, Got too excited. I'm going to go with a moment that is dear to us Giants fans. Meant a lot to us. A lot of beautiful memories from it. It is a throw from Eli Manning to Mario Manningham that completely turned that game around. And ultimately... Not turned it around. It just won them the game. And it was an unbelievable throw. And I'll never forget that for the rest of my life.
About that. That, if this was a top six list, would have made the cut. But since this is a top five, it did not, because the football moment that is on the list was one that actually legitimately did win the game without needing anything else after it. So let that be your hint.
Okay. The Patriots touchdown to win it in overtime?
No. That was a lame touchdown.
That was a super lame touchdown. That's why you said it was legitimately to win the game.
It doesn't have to be Super Bowl. It has to be in the playoffs. Super Bowl is just part of the playoffs.
Oh, the Minneapolis Miracle.
Stephon Diggs.
Okay. January 2018 versus the 4-seed Saints in Minnesota in the NFC divisional game. Catches the pass from Case Keenum, and the Vikings were down 1 with 10 seconds left in the game. It is the first NFL playoff game in history to end on a touchdown as time expired. That is number 2 on the list.
Yeah, I mean, that was an unbelievable moment. But Manningham, it's not even on the list. Like, it's such a big...
Again,
Matt, you're letting your Jets fandom come out.
That was like
you're
a two-foot window he stuck that ball into.
Okay, which actually won the game? Did the Minneapolis Miracle actually win the game? Or did Manningham just set up...
Yeah, but that was a blown defensive... That was a miss. That was a defensive miss. That wasn't like a...
He still has to complete the throw. He still got to get into the end zone.
I have to agree with Matt. You both are letting your Giants fandom bias your decision.
And you can't say it's a Jets fandom here because it's a Vikings game.
Stephon Diggs, my former classmate and study buddy, displayed freakish athleticism for that incredible catch.
Can I throw out, since we're talking about former classmates, I actually took a class with David Tyree. We were in the same group, so... Speaking of greatest Super Bowl catches of all time,
unfortunately, that one is out of the list because it's too long ago.
So you guys have the number two of the NFL, and you have the number 3, which was 1 of the 2 NBA. You still need the NHL, MLB, and one more NBA, guys.
You have one,
Jared. Were you joking, or did you actually take a class with David Tyree?
No, I'm dead serious. We were in the same class together.
Get back on track to the segment, Walt?
Okay, so for the MLB, I'm thinking this was a big moment in your life. You and I have been friends for a long time. You were at Albany during this. I'm thinking it was Game 6, David Freese home run. Even though I don't think it's legitimate.
That missed the cut, and I'll explain why. Because without the triple... Those are really two moments that were needed to make them both great, because one without the other doesn't happen. So that did not make the list.
I know this is not going to be on your list, Matt, but I'm just saying this for the fans, and I have to go with Daniel Murphy in the 2015 NLCS when the Mets swept the Cubs, his incredible home run.
No, not even close.
Okay, how about this one?
Winners, things that won the game, won the series.
I guess my next one was an almost win. Rajay Davis's home run in Game 7 of that Cubs-Cleveland series, where he hit the home run off Chapman to tie the game.
No, because they
go on to lose. That's the problem with that.
I know.
If they would have won that game, absolutely. But they didn't win that game. Come on, think someone that won a game, won a series. Come on.
This is tougher than I thought.
Tell you what, I'll even tell you, it was in the NL. It was part of the NL playoffs. It happened in the first half of this past decade.
Wait. Okay, here's one. I don't know if you're going to count it because it's quote-unquote not a moment. What about the unbelievable performance that Madison Bumgarner had?
No, but you are starting to think the right team. Think those Giants. Think what happened.
No, you're gonna give it to us.
I have to give you guys this one? Really? Travis Ishikawa, pennant winning home run.
Yeah, that's fair.
2014 that's fair. NLCS. Fair. Game 5 versus St. Louis. The game played in San Francisco. The first ever NLCS ending home run. The first pennant clinching home run in NL history since 1951 when Bobby Thompson did it. Guys, that's number 5 on the list over here.
You could give me 30 more guesses. I wouldn't have gotten close to that one.
There's something wrong with your baseball viewing if you went down that one. You still need number 1 on the list, and you still need number 4 on the list. You have an NBA moment mixed in there and an NHL moment.
Can I throw in some New York bias here, what I think the NHL moment might be?
You may try.
Rangers are down 3-1 in a series against the Pittsburgh Penguins. Rangers come back to tie the series. They're in an overtime game, and Carl Hagelin nets a Game 7 winner to move the Rangers past the Penguins.
You're a year too early.
Oh, I think I've got this one then, unless anyone else has one.
I think I know what it is.
Is it the Martin St. Louis Mother's Day goal?
I said you're a year too early. Martin St. Louis was 2014.
Ah.
It was before the Hadlin. I said you're a year too early with Hadlin.
Okay. That was actually my guess as well.
Come on. Look, Dan, I can understand you and Walt not having... Jared, as the Ranger fan that you are, the Garden has never rot. The only time the Garden has rot as loud or louder was when they won the Cup in 1994 compared to this moment. Come on. I'm giving you the year. It's 2015. Still a 7th game after being down 3-1 in the series against the Capitals. And they won in overtime.
Ryan McDonough?
Derek Stepan, Game 7 overtime winner versus the Capitals. Off the faceoff, out to Girardi, who fires the shot out on net, rebound out to Stepan, and Bedlam breaks loose at Madison Square Garden. That takes number 1, and that is our New York moment and our NHL moment. You guys still need number 4.
Wait. Hold up. You put that over the block? What?
Well,
okay.
Remember, we're doing by sports here.
Okay, here we go.
So you still have one basketball moment left.
Okay, let's think about this. So not the block, not the step back, not Ray Allen's shot.
Well, I'll give you a hint. This particular moment was a step back, just not the one that you were thinking of.
Step back, but not the one we were thinking of. Wow, this is not easy. This is not easy, Matt. Let me think about this.
Think about it. It was something that won a series for a team that hadn't won a series in over a decade in front of their hometown fans. A player who announced his arrival to the national audience, a series-clinching buzzer beater in the playoffs to advance his team for the first time in 14 years. That should be your hint.
Is Carmelo Anthony involved here?
No, Carmelo Anthony is not involved here.
Who?
Dive, come on. If you looked up any YouTube video...
Dirk Nowitzki.
No, if you looked up any YouTube video of NBA greatest moments, this is one of the highlights. Come on. You guys are making our fans who are texting in worrying about your sports knowledge.
Oh, let me think about this. I'm not... First of all, I'm thinking of, did Curry have a game winner that I'm not remembering?
No, but at least you're correct that it's a Western Conference team.
Well, that's
and it was 2014.
It was 2014 in the Western Conference, and it's not... Oh!
An underdog, 14 years in the making.
Damian Lillard.
Hallelujah. And I know Walt looked at his laptop to find that out, but it's Damian Lillard's.
Matt, this list is ludicrous.
No,
Matt,
it's
this
not.
List is
over the block?
It's a bad list. Ray Allen is the greatest playoff moment.
The block did not win the game. Yes, it changed the complexity of the game in the series. Not saying no on that. It did not win the game. It did not win the series. The buzzer beater by Lillard won the series for the first time in 14 years for the Trailblazers.
And yet you put a fluke throw to Stephon Diggs over arguably one of the best goal line defensive plays in Super Bowl history. I hate your list. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess one person can be wrong and always find a friend in this case, or two friends in this case. As you guys clearly don't have, you know, aren't thinking clear. You have a Game 7 overtime winner in the second round of a hockey playoffs. You have the first ever NFL playoff game to end on a touchdown as time expires. You have two buzzer beaters in the NBA playoffs, and you have a pennant-winning home run. Those are great moments, guys. So,
great moments, but not the greatest moments, in my opinion.
Well, I guess a broken clock can be right twice a day in your case. So, guys, beyond the list, which obviously there's going to be some debate about it, I'm sure we'll continue once we're well off air. We might have to post some extra content. I'd like to say that, you know, we have just a couple minutes left here, and it's been a pleasure, the list notwithstanding, to have our 21st episode be the first one with the four of us all doing the show together to really bring home four different aspects of sports knowledge to one show. So, guys, I want to give a round of applause to everyone for making it through with this show. And Dan, I see you're wearing a Boy Meets World shirt. Is there a reason for that, that you're wearing that to a sports radio show?
Boy Meets World is exactly like sports. You have the main star of the show, Mr. Ben Savage, who played Corey Matthews very famously. And what was he? He was like the point guard. He didn't say the funny lines. He didn't do that. But he always was the leadership. He always taught the lessons. And then you had Topanga, who was the star. And she was the one who everybody came in to watch. And that's like the LeBron of the team. So, yes, Boy Meets World is exactly like basketball. It's exactly like sports.
Jared, Walt, you guys buying that? Because I don't know that I am.
It's an interesting comparison. My real question is, Jared, you took a class with David Tyree?
Yes, I did.
All right, tell us about that, because clearly that's something that's been on Walt's mind for 15 minutes at this point.
Yeah, no, during my getting an MBA online, so my company has a thing with Indiana University, and apparently so does the NFL Players Association. So a lot of NFL players get degrees at Indiana, and so while I was getting mine there, David Tyree was in my class, and I was, you know, I was like, you made my childhood. Let's be on the same team, and yeah.
Did he pull his weight?
He was working in the front office of the Giants at the time. I think he was helping with like player development or something like that. So he's a nice guy to work with. He's a bright guy.
Well, I'm not doubting the brightness of him. He's obviously smart to go for his degree in that. That's got to be a very intriguing thing to have. I mean, Jared, we know you're a diehard Giants fan. For when you first saw his name, you know, on the class registry, I'd have to imagine you just about fainted.
Oh, and immediately I was like, I don't care what I have to do. We'll be on the same team.
I have to imagine that every time Jared tried to speak in that class, English did not come out. It was just pure gibberish.
Jared, care to confirm or deny that?
No, thankfully I was able to make words come out of my mouth.
All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, Jared, thank you for that very unique story. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for you today. And if you missed our live show, as always, you can catch the recordings on thenyextra.com, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes and Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. So please tune back in next Friday, June 4th, at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for more Hot and Cold Sports Takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blitner. To my left is co-host Daniel Green, special guest co-host Walt Bonet, and new special guest co-host Jared Fertig, saying thank you for tuning in, and if you enjoy our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, please visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full work, and we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.